Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is Jason Ahmet, and I represent Samantha Hall. I have with me Mr. Frandina and Mr. Allison, who have been present for the other two arguments. This is a hotly contested lawsuit. And like all lawsuits, the facts surrounding it are not perfect. They just aren't in environmental cases like this. All the sides make good points. The defendants make lots of good points, and they put forward lots of strong arguments. We feel we've put forward some strong arguments and should have been able to survive summary judgment. Now, in cases like these, there's a lot of facts and there's a lot of data. And in this case, the parties agree on many of the facts, but they don't even agree, for instance, on how long Ms. Hall lived at the home that she lived in, because her mother, who abandoned her, had one piece of testimony, and her father, who was incarcerated, had another. And she, of course, had a third when she was couch surfing on her uncle's couch, and neither her incarcerated father nor her abandoned mother knew exactly where she was. But all those facts aside, there are three main issues for your consideration. And by the way, the defendants do an amazing job of taking advantage of those kinds of inconsistencies to try and raise a defense that they did in this case. But there are three main issues for your consideration, and they're whether or not the district court's refusal to consider circumstantial evidence because it decided that Ms. Hall had not personally experienced benzene was reversible error, and two, whether the district court's line drawing regarding Dr. Gore's exposure assessment was an abuse of discretion under Daubert. And then finally, whether or not the court viewed the facts before it in a light most favorable to Ms. Hall or to ConocoPhillips? Now, two points require noting. We agree with the district court that specific causation can be proved with circumstantial evidence. That was a finding that the district court made that was in our favor, and we agree with the district court on that. We also agree that the district court got it right, that differential diagnosis is a method that is used by experts in a field like medicine, like Dr. Gore, to determine specific causation.
Doesn't the reliability of differential diagnosis depend just logically on the assumption that science currently knows all of the factors that can cause a particular ailment?
Before you reach the differential diagnosis step and specific causation, you would do a general causation analysis. The district court assumed, based on Dr. Martin Smith's testimony, that general causation was met in this case.
Well, okay, so I don't think that that's answering my question, and I'll tell you why.
Okay, I'm sorry if I misunderstood.
No. You understood it, but this is why I don't think it's responsive.
Okay.
Okay, so Dr. Smith might say that benzene is a reliable indicator of AML inverse 16,
mm-hmm.
that is a general cause of it. But let's say that there are 100 cases, theoretically, of AML inverse 16, and we know that benzene emissions causes it, we know that smoking causes it,
mm-hmm.
and we know that there are a whole lot of other factors that science hasn't caught up to this issue. We just don't know all of the factors that can that could satisfy general causation. So the premise of Dr. Gore's or any scientist's use of differential diagnosis seems to me to logically have to assume that science knows all or virtually all of the causes of AML inverse 16.
And I think actually the law supplies the answer to your question. I misunderstood it as a scientific question, Your Honor. That really does. This court has decided that an expert doesn't have to consider every potential possible cause. I think Judge Murphy was one of the judges in that case. We cited it's the Bittler case. An expert doesn't have to cite consider every potential possible cause. In this case, the parties all agree there were a universe of potential causes that needed to be considered.
Well, the parties don't agree that about the idiopathic causes. In other words, your adversary, I think, argues quite strenuously that we don't know what a lot of these 75% or whatever the percentage of these causes of AML inverse 16 are.
Dr. Gore, however, did specifically consider whether or not Ms. Hall's leukemia was idiopathic. He referenced it in his original report. He referenced it in his supplemental declaration. He referenced it in his testimony before the district court. We referenced it in all of our briefing. Idiopathic was considered. What the defendants don't like about Dr. Gore's opinion on whether or not Ms. Hall's leukemia had no cause or some unknown cause is that he doesn't agree with them. Right? But that's not a reason to exclude his testimony or to grant summary judgment.
Why not? Let's say in those 100 cases of AML inverse 16.
Sure.
That benzene emissions causes, say, 5 of those cases. Say, 5 of those cases, are caused by smoking. And we just don't know why 90, or I'll use a more, a statistic that's in this case, 75% or 90%. We just don't know what those causes are. And so on the differential diagnosis, you have to rule in all of the potential causes, right?
Right.
So you rule in benzene emissions, you rule in smoking, and you rule in idiopathy or idiopathic causes.
You rule in an unknown cause.
But what does that mean?
Right.
And so you rule out, how can you rule out idiopathic causes when we don't even know what they are?
Well, that syllogism that the defendants raise is a pretty enormous problem with their argument, right? It essentially asks every expert who would testify in this area to determine that the boogeyman under the bed didn't cause it. And of course,
I don't want to argue with you. I'll shut up after this. But
I
understand what your argument is, but I think the argument is simply that under Daubert, mm-hmm. reliability cannot be that differential diagnosis cannot be a reliable tool when the vast majority of causes of a particular ailment are simply unknown. And so, I mean, your adversary didn't write Daubert, we didn't write Daubert, but Daubert exists. And so how can, logically, to use your boogeyman analogy, how can we avoid, you know, the quandary that I'm struggling with?
I think it's the word likely, and I think it's found in the Bittler versus A.O. Smith case, right? The expert isn't required to make some epistemological search for every potential possible cause. He only has to look at those causes that are likely based on the facts and the circumstances of the case. Otherwise, we are looking for boogeymen.
Doesn't that mean then that you don't have to rule out idiopathic things because they're unknown? You can't rule them out. It just seems you cannot rule them out.
Well, I don't think that Dr. Gore specifically said that idiopathic was ruled out. I think what he said was when he considered idiopathic and he considered smoking and he considered obesity and he considered the benzene, he said benzene is most likely the cause, and smoking is also a potential cause, right? But that left him with choosing from among those causes. He applied the differential diagnosis faithfully according to the way that it's always been applied in all these cases.
It seems to me this is something you can take and run with, and that is it is impossible to rule out unknown things.
Well, absolutely. And you know, ConocoPhillips has been pressing this issue on behalf of the petrochemical industry in this case, essentially trying to overrule what are decades of this court's authority for a purpose that really is intended to create an almost insurmountable barrier for the industry in all of these cases. It's a very dangerous precedent that they're trying
to
set.
You would say this goes to not the admissibility, but the weight. They're perfectly able to cross-examine all day long with your expert on the fact that there's a body of these AML cases that the cause is unknown.
Exceptionally able to do it, actually. And they prove their ability to do that in the cases below. The things that I would like to point out in terms of what Dr. Gore did right in this case, in doing his differential diagnosis, was when he relied on the circumstantial evidence, right? So he said, when you look at his original report, which is starts at Appellate Appendix 3816, at paragraph 16 and 17, he says, in his standard practice, he assesses what all the causal factors are that can be identified, not as all of them, but as are probably contributed to the individual's patient's disease. That's the way an expert does it. They say, what's probable here?
Well, when we're dealing with toxic torts, don't we have, there's a threshold above which it's not safe to be exposed.
Right.
And so as a result, don't we need to know the dose that the plaintiff was actually exposed to?
Yes, but Your Honor, I would take issue with the word dose. I think dose is a red herring in this case.
Level?
Exposure. Right? It's the level of exposure. In this case, what's known, it's assumed that whatever a person is exposed to for benzene is how much benzene impacted them. That's all it is. It's a very simple analysis in these benzene cases. There's no question of whether or not it was all absorbed or some of it was excreted or some percentage should be considered. What they're exposed to is what their, quote, dose is.
So your argument is if the plume reached the property where your client was living,
right,
we can assume your client breathed it in and was exposed.
And that's what all of the experts in all of these cases do. In fact, defense's expert, Dr. Spencer, did exactly that and provided the district court with an analysis of Ms. Hall's exposure and says that Ms. Hall was exposed up to 0.147 part per million years of benzene, which, according to some of the circumstantial cases, would have been enough all on its own to have caused her leukemia.
Well, doesn't that assume that the underlying premise of the issue, I think, is that there has to be some scientific threshold,
yeah,
of how many parts per million the benzene emissions constitute over a sustained period of time.
Right.
And so the use of Dr. Gore's use of the one-hour peak hour based on what Dr. Mitchell says, and then Dr. Mitchell's expertise, and then Dr. Mitchell says, well, that's not my expertise, that's Dr. Gore's expertise. So you have this, you know, pointing the fingers at each other. And the bottom line is, how can you then have a reliable assessment of how much the benzene exposure was in order to attribute the AML inverse 16 to it?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. And that is one of the issues at the heart of it, all of this, right, is how did Dr. Gore make the assumption that he made that it was this highest and hourly number? And he talks about that in some great detail in his supplemental declaration.
Which was stricken.
Well, the portion of it that relied on Dr. Eade was stricken. His supplemental declaration itself wasn't stricken, but the portion that relied on Dr. Eade was stricken. And none of this relied on Dr. Eade. All he said was, I had a long discussion with Dr. Mitchell about this, and, you know, Dr. Mitchell told me that I had these different choices of, I could have done 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half hour, daily, yearly, monthly, weekly. And I chose an hour. And he has a very long and cogent discussion about why he did that. He gave essentially the same discussion of it on the stand when he testified in front of the judge. You'll find that at Appellate Appendix 3816 at paragraphs 30 and 31.
I mean, Dr. Mitchell's testimony was not stricken, right?
Dr. Mitchell's testimony was not stricken.
And Dr. Mitchell provided monitoring data that covered the entire period that Ms. Hall lived in the various locations.
Your Honor, Dr. Mitchell provided modeling data, and with respect to monitoring, because the defendants criticized Dr. Mitchell for not considering the monitoring, but actually Dr. Mitchell did, and he came to the Daubert hearing and he testified quite clearly on the October 6th docket at pages 196, line 9 to 198, line 7, about how he reversed his model around and was able to show that the measurement data that the defendant's using were not accurate, but that the model could accurately predict what the measurement data was. So he did exactly what the defendant said that they couldn't do and was able to show that his model was accurate and accurately predicted the amount of benzene that she was exposed to.
Well, I guess the question of whether it accurately or different didn't accurately, what we have is modeling data that was provided by an expert that purports to show how the plume traveled from the refinery and impacted the residents around.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
Okay, and from that data, one can make calculations as to the parts per million on a particular day.
Yes, Your Honor. And
they were hourly figures?
There were hourly figures, there were yearly figures, there were monthly figures. And, Your Honor, I think that you're driving right.
And then we could fight about whether you take the peak number and multiply that by the number of years she lived there, or we could fight about whether you take an annual average and multiply that, or we take the numbers from every hour of every day for the period.
That's right, but it just becomes really a fight over what the assumptions were. I think, Your Honor, you're pointing out, the authority, for instance, that starts with the In Re TMI litigation. Cases that say that Daubert doesn't preclude testimony merely because it's based on an assumption. And then the Edison case recently from the District of New Jersey that says that Edison versus Etsedco Noble Claims, it says that the assumptions just have to be sufficiently grounded in the facts.
You cited Mitchell's testimony.
Yes, sir.
You just gave us the page. But what was the basis for his using only the peak hour?
Yeah. Your Honor, can I summarize it for you?
Absolutely. Please do.
Sure. What he says is, and I've got it right here, he says that he understood from discussing the matter with Dr. Mitchell that his air modeling was very conservative in nature because it averaged the fugitive emissions from the refinery across the entire year. What the defendants did is they gave us was a single number of all of their emissions for the, so Dr. Mitchell had to assume that the emissions were the same on every day, on every hour of every day, which of course we know they're not, right? And so Dr. Mitchell discussed this with Dr. Gore, and they discussed the fact that actually, you know, sometimes there's more emissions and sometimes there's less emissions. And so he said, you know, these fugitive emissions don't occur continuously. Rather, in Dr. Gore's words, he said they occur sporadically. So he points out, he says, you know, the defendants would...
But wait, you were going to give me a summary. Why did he pick the peak hours?
Oh, well, because he, in his own words, he says, and I'll just skip right to this point, he says, I chose the hourly figure in part because it was the reasonable midpoint in the potential analysis. He could have chose numbers that would have yielded a much higher dose for Ms. Hall, and he could have chosen numbers that would have yielded a much lower dose, but this highest hourly from Dr. Mitchell's model was a reasonable midpoint. Now, the defendants take issue with this. They say that it yields a very, very high number. And they say that if Dr. Gore would have selected a highest hourly figure, or rather, highest yearly figure, the number would have been much smaller. In fact, actually, what defendants did in Mr. Spencer's report, he's not a PhD, they did an analysis instead of just 10 different sampling days that were taken inside people's homes. And so those certainly were sampling days, but then the defendants criticized that same sampling by saying it wasn't even in Ms. Hall's home, saying that it wasn't relevant from their own scientist's perspective. The facts aren't pretty. These assumptions have to be made to try to get at the truth about something that occurred based on the best and most truthful application that the scientists can make of their disciplines.
I'm going to ask you one more question, I'm sorry, on fugitive emissions. That's all estimates, right? You don't have any data on fugitives because they're based on the source's own estimates. Is that correct?
That's correct. And in 2010, Your Honor, the ConocoPhillips reported to the public that it emitted 2,000 fewer pounds of benzene that it admitted to the EPA privately that it actually emitted that year. These estimates aren't even close. They're the best evidence, however, that is available.
I do want to follow up with you. Our interrogation of you is taking you way over time. But
thank you, Your Honor, for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Well, these are important issues. Let me ask you to clarify your answer to Judge Murphy just a moment ago. When you were explaining why Dr. Gore picked the one-hour peak exposure period as far as a reliable midpoint, were you reading from the supplemental declaration, or what was the source of your answer to Judge Murphy?
Yes, Your Honor, I was reading from the supplemental declaration.
All right, and then in Dr. Gore's in Dr. Mitchell's in his deposition, I'm sorry, did he not say that I picked the 1 hour because that's what toxicologists generally ask? That's what they always ask me for.
He did say that. He said absolutely that when you do these kinds of analysis of the toxicological impacts, this is generally the hour that you use.
Was it an abuse of discretion to say that if Dr. Gore was relying on Dr. Mitchell pinpointing for purposes of what threshold is sufficient to correlate benzene emissions to AML inverse 16, that it would be within the district court's discretion to say that that's not a reliable indicia is what an expert is generally asked by other experts?
If that was the only thing that Dr. Gordon relied upon, was Dr. Mitchell saying, this is what I've done in other cases, then I think the district court would have considered all the evidence. But it was the only evidence that the district court looked at. And while the district court's opinion, I would point out, with respect to this line drawing over the exposure assessment is given some deference, the district court's refusal to even apply the Daubert analysis at all to Dr. Gore's circumstantial evidence and his differential diagnosis based on circumstantial evidence is not entitled to deference and should be reviewed de novo under Cartel.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll hear from Mr. Young.
Thank you, Judge Bacharach. May it please the Court, my name is Brett Young on behalf of the appellees. I want to start with a critical law point that should put at least two-thirds of these issues to rest, which is circumstantial evidence alone in a latent disease case like this cannot and can never sufficiently prove specific causation. This Court need look no further than its own case in Hollander, where the Hollander Court said, issues that are not within the ordinary realm of experience of mankind require expert evidence to get to a jury. And that is not a novel concept. We heard that concept argued by co-counsel here just 30 minutes ago, that we need expert witnesses to prove causation in a case like this. There is no circumstance under which wisps and threads of circumstantial evidence can sufficiently raise a tribal issue of fact in a case like this. Now, there was nothing mentioned about Dr. Calvi either by Mr. Emmett or in questions. So what I'm going to do is focus my time on the questions concerning Dr. Gore.
But before you go there, I just have this general concern that I think some of your evidence indicated that some 90% of the cases could be attributed to idiopathic matters, right?
Yes, sir.
Aren't you necessarily saying then that this case, or benzene generally, is not subject to the standard of differential diagnoses because one can never rule out unknown causes?
The answer is no. I'd like to explain.
I wish you would.
First, let me start with what de novo or idiopathic AML means.
Okay.
This court can find the testimony of Samantha Hall's treating physician, Nassim Naboot, in the record at pages essentially 88 to 100, where Dr. Naboot understood and testified that the definition of de novo AML is one that arises in the absence of prior leukemogenic exposures without smoking, without benzene, without ethylene oxide, without ionizing radiation. That is de novo AML. And as clinicians define this term, 75 to 80% of those cases that they see in hospitals, which is where this literature comes from, are de novo AML. That is the definition of it. Now, under this court's jurisprudence in Bittler, and in the Tabor case where you, Judge Bacharach, and you, Judge McHugh, applied the Bittler standard, the legal standard for ruling in is whether or not something has an established connection to the outcome and can it be ruled out as highly improbable. That is the law of the Tenth Circuit under Bittler and Tabor and others. Nothing has a more established connection than what happens 8 times out of 10. And the question posed earlier, well, is it impossible to rule it out? It is absolutely not impossible to rule it out.
But you can only rule it out in acute cases, like Christian versus Gray.
Oh, Judge, I disagree. I think that if you had a case where someone was exposed to high-dose pulse ionizing radiation and they had a high enough exposure in the scientific literature to be at risk for AML, if they had high-dose chronic benzene exposure.
That's Christian versus Gray, though, isn't it?
Christian versus Gray was an acute exposure case with an acute symptom. It had nothing to do with
well,
a long-term...
Well, you're talking about this exposure in your hypotheticals. That's like an acute exposure.
Judge, it's not an acute exposure. It's a high exposure over a long time with the interval of a long latency that causes cancer. It is a chronic exposure with a chronic endpoint as opposed to an acute exposure with an acute endpoint. The four cases that appellant cites...
Well, so in other words, okay, so you're taking, you know, the Christian versus Gray, you say, is acute because it was a particular incident. And you're saying it's different if I'm working right next to a open barrel of benzene for 15 years. You're saying that that's not acute, that's chronic, and it's not subject to being required to rule out idiopathic reasons.
Judge, if I said that, then I misspoke. You have to rule out de novo AML in any circumstance. In Christian versus Gray, the plaintiff walked into a circus tent, was enveloped in a cloud of lime dust, and a few days later was in the hospital complaining of respiratory disease. It is an acute exposure one time with an acute symptom. Chronic exposure to benzene has a chronic endpoint. That is a form of acute leukemia after the elapse of many, many years. There's a difference between a chemical that causes an acute symptom, like a nosebleed or like a cough, and something that causes cancer after 20 or so years.
Well, actually, the terms better be immediacy versus longer term, right?
I'm sorry.
When you use the word acute, you're talking about an immediate, manifestation.
An immediate manifestation or one within a very short time interval, which is what those cases all describe. Christian, Curtis, and Westbury, all three of those cases are cases where someone had an acute exposure, a high-dose, one-time exposure, followed by an immediate response. And in the latter two cases, Westbury and Curtis, when the worker was removed from the work environment, the symptoms went away. That's because they are acute symptoms that come and go depending upon an acute exposure. Benzene-induced AML, just look at footnote one.
Well, tell me in a chronic, you tell me where there would be a case of chronic exposure to benzene where there would be no necessity to rule out idiopathic matters. I call them matters. They're not reasons.
Judge,
they are no reasons.
Judge, de novo AML has to be ruled out in every single case, and it can only be ruled out on the basis of sufficient exposure. In the absence of sufficient exposure to benzene, benzene cannot be ruled in as a plausible cause or an established connection, and an idiopathic cannot be ruled out because the exposure isn't there.
So
if you have an exposure to a high level of benzene over a period of time, how do you rule out? And so you have a likelihood. You can rule it in.
Correct.
Okay. And you have also this mass of idiopathic leukemia caused.
Understood.
How do you rule out what we don't know in favor of the benzene we do know?
Well,
is that your question, right?
I understand the question. It's a very good question. The first answer ought to be that would have been fascinating for Dr. Gore and Dr. Calvi and Dr. Smith to do because they never addressed the issue because they never had sufficient exposure in the first place. But if you had a case, which is not Samantha Hall, but one if you had one, let's say there was 200 part per million years exposure, above the threshold that even we recognize increases the risk of AML, then you would look at the particular individual and say, does this match what other people in the scientific literature show? Did it happen in the appropriate time interval within, say, 5 to 7 years latency? Are there biologic indices in their bone marrow and other things that tie high-dose exposure to the disease? That's just not this case.
But your explanation to both my colleagues seems circular to me because it seems to me that in your appeal brief, you're arguing that there are two independent flaws of Dr. Gore's methodology. One, the dose exposure using the one-hour peak time period that it was the finger pointing the finger at one another with Dr. Mitchell, and then the separate issue about the failure to reliably rule out idiopathic causes. And so in answer to both of my colleagues' questions, your answer turns on your assumption that there was not a chronic exposure to enough benzene to have triggered AML inverse 16. Your adversary says, well, yes, there was. There was plenty of, it did cross that threshold. But that's what the court was there to decide. So if your answer is to the ability to reliably rule out idiopathic causes turns on your premise that there was inadequate exposure to benzene emissions, then I think you're back to square one. It's a completely circular argument.
Let me see if I can square the circle for you, if I can. Dr. Gore's dose calculation was in and of itself inherently unreliable, both for his blind reliance on Dr. Mitchell. In this court's case in TK7 against Barbuti explains when an expert can reliably rely upon a co-expert for data, and he doesn't satisfy.
Well, people all the time, you have a modeler.
Yes.
And then you have an expert that relies on the modeling
yes.
data. Isn't that what we have? Dr. Mitchell did modeling.
Dr. Mitchell
aired
did do
dispersion modeling and came up with, tracked the plume, shall we say, of emissions and had information about the emissions on various time intervals, right?
Yes.
Okay, and that wasn't stricken. We have that. That's in the record.
Yes.
Okay, so there's modeling data that an expert could rely on.
Yes.
Okay. Why can't Dr. Gore look at that and choose? He says it's conservative. Maybe it's actually the most aggressive to take the peak hour number and multiply it by the maximum amount of time she lived in the area. But why isn't that appropriate for an expert to do? And then you come in and you say, this is ridiculous. This is the peak hour. And actually, if you look at the average, it would be a different number. Why isn't that just proper cross-examination at trial?
Two answers. One is law, one is fact. Let me focus on the law answer first. The court's jurisprudence here in the TK7 Corp against Barbuti case says that a co-expert who relied on another expert's underlying data adopted it with no investigation and no expertise to investigate whether the underlying data was appropriate in the first instance. Dr. Gore's testimony, deposition, and at the Daubert hearing was, I relied on Mitchell. Dr. Mitchell's testimony was, I'm not qualified or prepared to do anything like this. That's what the toxicologists are there for. So Dr. Gore's blind reliance on Mitchell as a matter of law is insufficient. As a matter of fact, regardless of his blind reliance on Mitchell, there are independent other bases that the district court pointed out to make his dose assessment unreliable. They're treated in our brief, but let me highlight a few. First, he modeled the wrong chemical. Volatile organic compounds as opposed to benzene. Second, he used the wrong duration. He's immediately off by 200%. How can an expert be off by 200% and be considered to be applying reliable scientific principles and in a reliable way?
Well, isn't this one of the factual disputes of how long Samantha Hall actually lived in the area, in the affected area?
It's not a factual dispute if the court is looking at the record. Dr. Fisher was the expert who quantified how long she lived in the neighborhood. It's right there in his report. It's right there in a table. He testified from the stand. When I asked him the question, how long, and his answer was 4 years. When I asked her, Dr. Gore, why did you use 8 instead of 4? Oh, I must have made a mistake. And then he recalculated his dose on the fly. Other reasons why Gore's methodology, independent of the Mitchell reliance, are unreliable. He had to calculate five or six different dose estimates. These mistakes are unsurprising from someone who admitted he isn't qualified and has never done the scientific discipline ever. Now, I only have 2 minutes, and I want to touch on the quantification issue, Judge. If I can, I think I can squeeze it in. It is uncontested and uncontestable that the peer-reviewed scientific literature reports that the lowest level ever reported in the scientific literature to increase risk of AML is a quantified level of 8 part per million years. That is the testimony of Martin Smith, the only benzene expert in this case, and this court can look to the courts of the District of Massachusetts and the Eastern District of Washington that has pulled the studies and reliably looked at them, reported that it is 8 part per million years. The dose in this case, regardless of which of Dr. Gore's 5 or 6 estimates, is too low. What that means is a matter of law and science that benzene cannot be ruled in as a possible cause. The law point is this court's jurisprudence in Mitchell against Gencor, Fifth Circuit case Allen against Penn Engineering, and several others. As a matter of law, benzene cannot be ruled in. Now, with 1 minute left, let me address general causation. Counsel is absolutely incorrect that the district court below assumed general causation to be there. That will not be found in the record, and that is inconsistent with this court's case of Richeson versus Ernest. It says this court can affirm the district court for any reason supported in the record. General causation is exclusively a function of what is in the scientific literature. Can something cause something else? All of the plaintiff's experts admitted under oath that there's not one study in the peer-reviewed literature associating benzene with AML with inversion 16. None means none. None means zero. And under this case, this court's case of Norris and Hollander, if an expert cannot deal with the contrary epidemiology, their general causation opinions are unreliable as a matter of law. Judges, I thank you for your time and for your questions. If there's anything else, I'm happy to answer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
This matter will be submitted. Thank you both, counsel, for your excellent advocacy, both in your briefs and today. This matter will be submitted, and the court stands adjourned until tomorrow at 8:30 a.m.